The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program, which is an open lines program tonight. And I will let you know when the phone line is opened. Right now it is disconnected, as there are a few things to talk about before I open the phone line. I want to thank all of you who are listening, because I know we have competition. Not only do we have the Democratic National Debate that is going on that many of you may want to listen to over on CNN, but also the playoff game between the Dodgers and the Mets is going on, and right now it's 3-1 in favor of the Dodgers in the top of the 7th inning. So I appreciate those of you who have chosen to listen to the live Space Show and participate with us via toll-free phone line and email rather than tune into the debate or to the ball game. The other thing is, most of you know that I've been out for a couple of weeks due to lower lumbar surgery, minimally invasive surgery, to remove fragments from the L4 nerve root, which also impacted the L5 nerve root. And I've been slowly recovering. And when they tell me it's a 4 to 6 week process, I no longer doubt them. I no longer think that I'm going to bounce back like I'm a 20-year-old spring chicken. I'm pissed off as hell, if I can say that on air, and recovery is no fun, but I am making progress. I have been out of the house driving myself rather than just being a passenger going to the pharmacy or the doctor or someone taking me to the market. I did go see The Martian, and we can talk about that in a little while if you want to. And I've been able to drive, and I can drive for short distances. I don't think I'd try driving from San Francisco to L.A., for example, and I don't think I'd drive in bumper-to-bumper traffic if I could avoid it. Being able to get out like that is really great. My dog is still in the kennel, but I'm getting Pepper out of the kennel on Saturday, so it'll be great to have her back and to start slowly walking back with her and getting some movement back. All of that will be good. But many of you have sent emails to me and wished me well, and I've gotten so many of them I can't possibly thank you all individually. And I wish I could do that, but there's just been so many I just can't do it. So I do want to take a moment to thank each and every one of you who have wished me well over the past several weeks. And it's meant a lot to me, and I really appreciate it very, very much, more than you can imagine. And I can't thank you enough. And I will always be indebted to your service. And listen, you guys were great, and it really made me feel good when sitting around stuck in weird positions. I mean, one of the things you can't do after lumbar surgery is sit up for very long, like working at a computer. And so a lot of my work is behind, especially we're running behind on the website development. I'll talk about that in a few minutes, and on the PERC processing, because that depends on me. But we're starting to get caught up, and I'm not too concerned about the delays bogging us down much longer, because I am able to spend more and more time sitting at the computer and being able to do things. And of course, I'm sitting doing the show tonight, although I will get up and stand and walk around in a little while. I won't sit for the entire time of doing the show. So again, thank you very much for your best wishes, your get well wishes, and your support. The other thing is, tonight's show is dedicated to the memory of my good friend and the space show friend, Declan O'Donnell. I did post a note on the blog about his passing on October 1st. And Declan was a true visionary. He envisioned a world of space governance that was very supportive to the commercial space industry. And he felt that if such space governance, which he formed in a company, or at least in a name called United Societies in Space, if it could be the prevailing entity, then he could do an end run around hostile regulators that have screwed up things like the Law of the Sea Treaty and stuff like that. So it didn't really catch on, but he did have a really impressive list of people that were part of his network. I don't think many of them showed up to Castle Rock, Colorado all the time for his meetings. His meetings were always at the same time I did a Sunday space show program, so I hardly ever got to participate, even by phone call. But Declan was a true visionary and very enlightened, and he was years ahead of his timeline. And I'm sorry to see him leave us, and he leaves children and his wife Linda behind. And great friends, great network, and Declan will always be remembered. And his shows are classics on the space show. They did really well. Whenever he was a guest on the space show, the ratings for those shows and the comments and stuff that I got were always first rate. Declan had a way of reaching people and getting his points across. He was a tax attorney licensed to practice in federal court in Denver as a career. And he was very persuasive, really good guy. And I met him doing my doctoral dissertation, and he tutored me on international space law and the UN treaties for my dissertation work. And he just gave endlessly of himself. So, Declan, we miss you, and tonight's show is certainly in memory of you. And you'll always be with us, and it's hard to lose some of our space friends who have played such an interesting and unique role in the development of the space industry. And Declan O'Donnell was one of them. He was also the legal advisor and a very impressive participant in helping to organize the Mars Society with Bob Zubrin. So Declan had his mark. He was also part of the ISDC meetings years ago before his health started to turn bad. Declan was a force in the industry, and I'm sure will continue to live on as a force to some degree or another as people research his work and understand more about USIS, United Societies in Space, was all about, and use as a model much of his work for going forward with some new ideas. So as we say, rest in peace, my friend. And thank you for all of you of what you've done for the space community, for the space show, and for me as your friend. I miss you very, very much. Website update. We clearly have lost time because of my being down. So I did use a lot of pain medication, primarily a non-narcotic called Tramadol. But it also knocked me out a lot. So I was unable to do very many detailed or comprehensive phone discussions with Spencer. And since I wasn't able to sit at the computer for very long, I was very limited to what I could do in design work with Spencer. And all of the PERC processing is really delayed, although I have now acknowledged and sent out thank you letters to all 136 Indiegogo participants for their participation, acknowledging the PERC that they participated in. And many of you didn't do a PERC, you just gave a donation. But if you have not received an acknowledgement and an official thank you note from One Giant Leap and the Space Show, I want you to let me know by email so I can take care of that. As far as my records show, every single one of you has received a thank you note with the official tax donation information in it and the acknowledgement for your PERC and all of that. and I'm complete. So if somebody has not received that, or if I made a mistake, and I could have made a mistake because I was on drugs at the time I was doing a lot of this, please, please, please email me so I can correct the record. I think that maybe by this weekend, Spencer will be able to start engaging the beta testers. There's three of them. I guess it's okay for me to tell you who they are because you can look them up on the Indiegogo website. So Jeff Smith in Tucson is one. Brian Whedon, Secure World Foundation, is another one. And Rick Kwan in Silicon Valley is another beta tester. And guys, I'm expecting that you will hear from Spencer on beta testing sometime this weekend, maybe at the very, very latest, early next week. But we're shooting for Spencer at least contacting you with an update and getting you an account set up and all of that by this weekend. And then, as I said, the next object for me to do is to start processing the perks, the T-shirts, the mugs, the lapel pins, the perks that involve merchandise, the perks that involve like co-hosting or your banner for being a sponsorship or your listening voices, that kind of thing. That doesn't start really until we have the new website up and running because there's no way to do any of that on the old website. So as soon as we launch the new website, that will open up the window for the rest of those perks to start happening. And, of course, I'm keeping everybody updated via the website. Not via the website, I'm sorry, being the blog, as well as doing shows like this from time to time, okay? So just keep paying attention. And obviously, if you have any questions, I want you to feel free to ask me. Another topic for discussion tonight, I saw the Martian, and I love the movie. I really enjoyed it a lot. Maybe I enjoyed it a lot because it's the first time I've been out of the house since the surgery. I took a bunch of pillows with me. People must have thought I was a weird nut, walking with a cane and a bunch of pillows to the movie theater from the parking lot. But it made it all possible, and I sat there without any difficulty, and I really enjoyed it. I will say this, I liked the book a lot better. I did read the book, and I thought the book was a lot better. I enjoyed the additional engineering and technology and stuff that Andy developed in the book that is obviously not in the movie, and Ridley Scott did a good job in the movie, and I guess if he'd put all that stuff in the movie, you'd have a four-hour movie, and people would have walked out on it because they probably don't even know what the word engineering means to begin with. But it's a great movie, and we can talk about it if you've seen it. I'm assuming that anyone listening to this show knows the story of the Martian, and they have either read the book, or they have seen the movie, or they know about it. So it's pretty inconceivable to me that we could say something that would be a spoiler alert, you know, that would ruin the movie for someone planning to go see it. Like, if Joe Blow calls in and tells us how the movie ends, is that really going to spoil it for someone who doesn't know what the movie's about and doesn't know how it ends? It's hard for me to think that way, but let's all be a little bit sensitive because there may be people who have not read the book and who do not know that much about the movie don't know how it ends. So, if you are going to, you know, do one of those spoiler alert things, give us a warning so people who don't want to hear the ending of it can plug their ears up or something like that and not have the movie ruined for them. But I thought the cast was great. I thought Matt Damon did a really good job, and Jeff Daniels as the jerk kind of asshole NASA director was outstanding. It's a really good part for Jeff Daniels. He did a really good job. And of course, Jessica Chastain, who can say anything bad about her? She was fabulous. They did a lot of zero gravity going around inside the space station in the Hermes space station when they left Mars and they were going home and then when they're going back to Mars. And, you know, they have them flying through the you know, through the zero gravity parts of the station. And then when they get to like the exercise floor and other things, they're in gravity because they're standing and, you know, there's no issue like that. When they show the picture of it, I believe you can see parts of the spaceship are turning. So that's why you can do that. I suspect that the ability to fly through the space station and go through no gravity, you know, like when you see the astronauts on the ISS doing, I suspect that's blue line work, you know, that they are able to do against a green screen or a blue screen, and then they brush it all out, and, you know, she's doing a breaststroke through the corridors of the CGI space station. But anyway, however they did it is really, really cool. The film was filmed in the deserts of Jordan and in Hungary, and the computer graphics are fabulous. And I'm telling you, I really enjoyed it, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. I know many of you have seen it because you've been emailing me and telling me that you saw it. So you can do that as a topic. And then one more topic before I open the toll-free line for your calls is I got an email from Matt, who is in Switzerland, and he heard the show with Ali that I did just before my surgery. And he said, I would like to follow up on the idea that you and Alexandra, when we called her Ali Abrams, who is the new PR director for the Space Frontier Foundation, discussed during the end of the show on September 29th. The idea was to organize a virtual training for space advocates on how to advocate for, quote, our cause. Even though I'm not a trained trainer, I'm willing to spend some time on preparing content for this type of training and, in general, pushing it forward. What is your take on it? And, caller, you're on hold, so you just have to sit tight. I'm looking forward to hearing the archive on this, because he's probably already in bed, because, as I said, he lives in Switzerland. He sent in a follow-up with a little bit more. He says, you might ask your listeners to write you a short message. Well, don't write me a short message. Post it on the blog. Those are our rules. Okay, don't write to me personally. We want it on the blog for everybody to see. So post a message on the blog. You know, he wants to have this topic discussed to see if there's some way to do space advocacy training or webinar training or something. He says his target audience for this message is not only the space enthusiast in the U.S., but also in Europe and maybe even other areas. This is a global topic. If we get a fair amount of feedback, perhaps you can introduce me to Ali Abrams to get her take on the project. Well, first of all, Matt, I don't need to introduce you to Ali Abrams, so you can go to Space Frontier Foundation's website, and they have a menu bar up at the top, and you go to the section that talks about who the team is, who the executives are of the Space Frontier Foundation, and you'll find Ali's name listed there, and you'll find her email address. And all you need to do is send her a note, tell her you heard her space show program, and you have question 12345, whatever it is you want to ask her. You do not have to wait for me to introduce you to Ali. I would urge anybody else to also do the same thing. So what I wrote back to him and told him was that most space advocacy organizations do offer advocate training for their membership for the advocacy of their projects. So like if you're going to go to the Mars Society deal and you're going to lobby for Mars policy in Congress, they have training for that, and ISDC has training for that. And if you're going to do something with Space Frontier Foundation, they have training for that as well. But I think what Ali and I were talking about, because Ali was talking big picture ways to do more effective communication that were not just necessarily applicable to space advocacy, but could be applicable to anything. You want to write a letter to your congressman, how do you, about health care or emission standards for your car or the EPA or, you know, whatever turns you on. How do you do a more effective job of that? How do you... you know, maybe do some effective PR or advocacy for a local policy with your local school board or something like that. So I think Allie's approach was not just related to space advocacy, although that was our topic, but it was how do you more effectively communicate on issues that are important to you that you want to advocate and be an enthusiast about. So that is a little different than saying being trained by the Mars Society to, you know, go to Congress and lobby on going to Mars or something of that nature. Whether there is already training like that available on the internet, I've never searched for it. But my hunch is if you could do a pretty good Google search on advocacy training workshops or seminars, virtual reality type, you know, things on the internet, I bet you could find quite a few of them that are available, many for free, and probably some like Richard Pryor Institute or things like that, where not only can you physically attend a workshop on better communication and advocation skills, but you can also probably do them online. But I'm putting it out there for people to respond to Matt, who is in Switzerland. So again, if you're interested in this topic, it was discussed with Allie Abrams, and she was the last show I did before my surgery. And that was September 29th. You can hear the show if you would like. And you might want to comment and offer Matt suggestions or maybe get something going with him or try to organize something. Use the blog. Again, it's thespaceshow.wordpress.com. Okay? Real quickly before I go to the call, our toll-free line is 1-866-687-7223. And remember to check out our detailed newsletter, which is on our website. I'm trying to think of whatever else I want to tell you about real quick. The Support the Space Show button is very important to us because we are a 501c3 nonprofit. We're able to bring you these shows and stay on the air because many of you do financially support us and contribute to us even way above what you've done for the Indiegogo campaign. Without your financial support, we would perish. So we thank you for that. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a deduction if you're eligible for it, and the same is true for those of you who pay for California taxes. Remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked, and please don't copy our shows or, you know, upload them to YouTube or edit them, and don't do anything commercial with them, and written transcripts are not permitted. Our copyright statement is in full at the bottom of every one of our website pages and One Giant Leap Foundation's website pages. Please pay attention to it, and we expect you to honor our copyright provisions. If you have a compelling need to do something with our show, just email me and let's see if we can work it out, okay? Podcasting is through Andrew at Gigadial, so the RSS URLs on our website, both of our newsletters, and we're in iTunes and a host of other places on the net, so check it out. We do have 5 new sponsors, but they don't start with us until the new website is launched. But so our existing sponsors, Spencer is a sponsor, but I'll talk more about his company called The Think Tank on later shows. We're also brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more info, go to their website, www.swfound.org. And they also sponsor our webinar series, and hopefully we're going to have another webinar before the end of the year with them. We're working on that, but the surgery has put me behind on that as well, and I need to make contact with Secure World over the next day or two to see how we're going on all of that. And then Tom Drigger is our life-saving 11th hour rescue website and broadcast engineer, who you've heard me talk about for years on the show. He's been with us for 13 and a half of our 14 years on the program, and you can find his information if you need his kinds of engineering and 11th hour emergency services on the sponsors page for both thespaceshow.com and onegiantleapfoundation.org. So those are my announcements. I mean, there might be other things in space that you want to talk about, but that's kind of what I wanted to get out. And let's see who our caller is, and I hope the caller had the patience to wait. Good evening, caller. Who are you, and welcome to the show?
David, Bill Rowe.
Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show. How are you doing? Thank you for waiting.
Yeah, I just want to say a few very, very briefly. I think there's been far too much hype in the news media recently about our walking on Mars by 2030. I've spent 25 years going through all this, and I've been on the show many times, but I just want to spend perhaps just 60 seconds or more and just get through a few points that I think are important, I think that all of you should pay attention to this. I have no idea how we would treat a heart attack en route, or how we would treat a heart attack which might occur in on Mars. I've emphasized the fact that just a year and a half ago, I published that Neil Armstrong developed probably heart failure on the moon, and that was just 4 days after liftoff. So we're talking about a 20-month a period in space, and there are several points that I think should be raised. Number one, we don't have the gastrointestinal tract doesn't function in space, and therefore anything that has to be given parenterally. Any medication has to be given, and all the minerals have to be given, but there's no device to administer them which is replenishable. For example, you can use a device which is the size of a pocket watch, which has a lot of various compartments containing various minerals and pharmaceuticals, but once it's released from the manufacturer, there's no way to replenish it. So that's a big problem. There are a few other points. There's no safe way to prevent decompression sickness other than using a device which really isn't safe at all, and that's using 100% oxygen to wash out nitrogen bubbles. That produces damage to the heart, and 100% oxygen is necessary for a couple of hours. We've got to find some other way. Another big problem is the fact that the carbon dioxide levels are 10 times higher than they are on Earth, and that in turn can damage the heart as well and damage the blood vessels because it can damage the energy-producing machinery of the heart. And then, really, basically, if we could develop some way of simulating Earth gravity, exactly Earth gravity, en route and on Mars while we're building habitats or tunnels or exploring, then some of these problems could be eliminated. But those are four major problems that have to be addressed. And again, I emphasize that I believe that until we do these things, we can't possibly have a civilization developing on Mars by 2030. That's all I want to say, David, and I wanted to get this across.
Well, you know, NASA has been talking up and has this roadmap to Mars for 2032 or something like that. And, you know, they're talking about humans to Mars. First we go back to the moon, then maybe an asteroid, who knows, then Phobos, and eventually we go down to the surface of Mars in the early part of the 2030s. But they don't talk about any of these issues. So is the assumption there that all of these issues that you and others raise are resolved and taken care of by this time?
I think that the problem is that I think that they're emphasizing that by 2030 we'll have the hardware to go. But I don't see, I can't find anywhere in the literature or on television or in newspapers where anybody is addressing the problems that I've addressed at all. So I think that they're talking about hardware by 2030. I have sent emails to people at NASA headquarters, and they responded to a certain extent, but really not very much. So I just think that perhaps, possibly, they know some things that I don't know. But so far, I think that the hype is way, way exaggerated.
So let me ask you something more personal. And I know there's microgravity going out to Mars, and you know maybe part of the spaceship is spinning, and you got 1G someplace on it, and Mars is 38%. But what if you get somebody who gets injured on this mission? And let's say something happens to somebody on this mission like happened to me. So they called this a spontaneous incident where the disc fractured and shot off pieces and embedded in the nerve root, and I needed surgery. How the hell do you do this surgery? You know, and how's somebody going to be able to be taken care of on a mission to Mars with fragments in their nerve roots in their spine? They can't move. I mean, the pain is excruciating. How do you deal with this stuff?
You can't deal with it. It's impossible. I think that we had great heroes going to the moon. I think that when they went to the moon, there was only a 50% chance that they would return. And so I think that anybody that volunteers to go to Mars must realize that there is no way to handle emergencies at all. And then en route back would be a long proposition of at least 90, I guess at least 6 months to return. And then you've got to wait till Mars and Earth are close enough together. So it requires a tremendous amount of heroism. And that's the end. That's the bottom line.
Well, I mean, I know they'd probably screen me out, so they wouldn't probably put me on a trip to Mars anyway. So, but you know, I guess if you had a history of back problems or something,
Somebody. Here we have Neil Armstrong, who was 39 years old and a healthy man,
and had heart problems.
And
yeah.
had problems just 4 days after liftoff. We had Irwin and Scott both got into trouble. Again, on the moon, I've published 2 or 3 articles about it. They were both very, very healthy when they left. Irwin was 40, 41, and Scott was about 40, and they both of them had significant disturbances of heart rhythm. Irwin, it's published by NASA that Irwin lost consciousness for a 30-second period related to a disturbance in heart rhythm when he was transferring from the lunar module to the command module. During reentry, you can read his autobiography, To Rule the Night. He was so short of breath, Irwin was so short of breath during 4 minutes of reentry at 7 Gs, and of course that 7 Gs is a lot, during the radio blackout of 4 minutes. He was so short of breath he couldn't say one word. Those are typical symptoms of congestive heart failure, and also had classical angina during reentry. 21 months later, he had a heart attack, and I went into space medicine because I had read that Irwin had a heart attack 21 months afterwards. So it's going to take heroism, a great deal of it.
You have an email from listener Doug in Southern California. Have you calculated what propellant it would take to spin up a craft with a tether long enough to get to 1G but relatively low RPMs?
Well, I think the problem with a centrifuge, and he's talking about a centrifuge, is that it would be I haven't calculated it, but I think that it would be quite, the tether would be quite long, and the fuel consumption, I think this is the problem. The fuel consumption would be a significant problem with the heavy lift capacity might not be adequate for a tether that's long enough for an adequate centrifuge. I believe, and I've argued it over and over again, that our genes demand 1G, and 0.9 isn't enough, 0.8 isn't enough, and I don't know what the answer is at this point. What I'm saying is that if we don't duplicate 1G, then at least the other three problems that I mentioned have to be addressed, and we'd have to do the best we can with those other three problems.
I did, just for fun, ask my neurosurgeon if he were on a trip to Mars, like in the movie The Martian, could he attempt to do something on a person who hurt their back, like he was going to do, you know, here on Earth to me? And I mean, it was just total bewilderment. How would you even begin to do that in that kind of an environment? So maybe there are people that know how to do that and have tried to work out how you can do microgravity surgery and stuff like that. And obviously he's not a space doctor, so he wouldn't know. But anybody can get injured. So if you want to, I guess it's what level of risk you're willing to tolerate for your crew members.
And I could go on. I could talk for hours about it. Another tremendous problem is dehydration, and it invariably occurs. The water is stored in the skeletal muscle primarily, and within 10 days or 2 weeks, you're already losing the reservoir for water in the skeletal muscles, plus the fact that because of microgravity, the blood vessels are leaky. They don't contain all the plasma that is necessary, and you've got leaking of plasma, and that in turn is conducive to high adrenaline and heart failure. And that's what happened to Neil Armstrong in just 4 days, and happened to Irwin and Scott in just a few days as well. Four moonwalkers came back from the moon with abnormal stress tests, but that we had a confounder in that situation, because this was after they had already inhaled the very toxic iron dust in the habitat. But Neil Armstrong had problems, and Irwin and Scott, even before they inhaled any toxic iron dust at all. So, David, those are just a few problems, and I don't want to take up any more time for anybody else.
Okay, well, I appreciate your call, and thank you for waiting as I went through the litany of opening announcements.
Hey, take care of yourself and listen to the doctors. Goodbye, David.
Thank you very much, Bill. I appreciate
Bye.
It. Bye. Bill has always given me great medical advice. I don't follow it all the time because he tells me to give up meat. And, boy, giving up meat from this Oklahoma kid is akin to fighting words. But Bill was, he'd probably, when he before he retired, probably was an absolutely great internist and doctor. And it would have been really rewarding to have him as your family doctor. I'm sorry I met him so late in life. Of course, we live on different sides of the country. He's in the Virginia area and I'm in California, but I have great respect for Bill, even though I don't always agree with many of the things that he says, but I certainly have no expertise to challenge his expertise. I'm not a medical doctor. Our line is available for anybody else who would like to call in. It is 1-866-687-7223. Surely some people out there have seen The Martian, and you would like to give us your 2 cents worth of what you thought of the movie. Did you think it was a good sci-fi movie? Was it garbage? You know, what did you think of it? Did it keep you spellbound? I mean, you know, to a large part, it's one character doing most everything, Matt Damon on the surface of Mars, except when they cut over to, you know, the NASA decisions at NASA headquarters and in Washington, D.C., and then they show you scenes of what's going on the spaceship. We have another caller on hold, and good evening, caller. Who are you and where are you?
This is John Fort Worth.
Hi. Welcome back, John. How you been?
Oh, pretty good. I'm glad to hear that you're on the recovery process. And
long process, let me tell you. It's not what I thought it was going to be. And that's actually a bone for me to pick. So here's a word of advice to people who are going to have surgery of any kind. You need to really know what to expect when you go home. I'm not talking about having your teeth pulled or a colonoscopy or something like that. I'm talking about real surgery, because I was not prepared. And when they dismissed me, and my son was there to take me home, and I'm on pain pills and I feel like crap, and the occupational therapist comes in and says, here are some rules for you with back surgery. And I'm thinking, rules for me with what the hell are you talking about? I don't know what, you know, and I'm not clear anyway. So number one, I need furniture that can support me, and I need to be able to lean back at like a 30 to 40% angle. I can't sit up straight for not more than 10 minutes at a time. well, I don't have any furniture that has a back that can lean back. My sofa, you know, isn't all that great for support anyway. My office chair, the back doesn't lead back. So that was all news to me. And then she said, you might try calling company ABCD and see if they will rent a hospital reclining chair for you. Oh, really? I need to rent a chair? Why didn't you tell me this, you know, a week before surgery, so I could have had this at the house waiting for me? Okay, then I found out that you can't sit very low when you have lumbar surgery. So this affects the type of chairs you have in the house, like if you're going to sit and eat dinner or something, and without being particularly too gross, it also affects being able to sit on a toilet, which is why they had hospital toilets with raised up things with grab bars and other stuff. And she says, what you need is something like what we have in the bathrooms here. And I'm thinking, how the hell am I going to get that at home? You know, this is a hospital toilet that you have. You know, I don't have anything like that. So I went home totally unprepared for what my post-surgical recovery was going to be like and what I needed to support my back and not to cause me more problems. And I had no clue of any of this. And had they told me ahead of time, I mean, they called me, they registered me, they did all this crap by phone. They were really good about everything. And I asked, what's my recovery going to be like? And they said, eh, no driving for 2 weeks, no dog walking for 2 weeks, this, this, and this. They didn't tell me how to prepare my home to be able to support me. And fortunately, my son was there, and he was able to build support out of pillows and things to support me properly. And he had to make emergency runs to a drugstore to find a toilet razor, if you can believe something like that. And then we ordered and rented a hospital reclining chair from a medical supply house, but they didn't bring that out until Monday, and I came home from the hospital on Friday. So if you're going to have surgery, don't rely on the fact that you're going to be told what you need in your home to help you for your recovery, assuming you may need something special. You find out ahead of time, you know, what you need, what devices you need to help you. I couldn't even take a shower. I was so unstable. So they told me where to go to get a walker with this service that loans you walkers for free, and then when you don't need them anymore, you turn them back in, and they loan them to somebody else, and to put a walker in the shower to give me stability because I don't have any grab bars in the shower. I mean, I couldn't even take a shower standing alone the first couple of days because I was not stable to stand up like that. So take it from someone who's gone through it. You really need to take the responsibility to find out what you are required to have in your house to support you in your post-surgery recovery, because most homes are not equipped to support people in post-surgery recovery, depending on what kind of surgery they've had. And if I had known ahead of time, it would have been a lot less stressful, and everything would have been there waiting for me when I got home, rather than having to get on the phone and find it and spend 3 or 4 days getting it and all of that. So anyway, that's an aside, but it's just a suggestion to people. If you do end up having to have surgery, find out ahead of time what you need in order to set your home up to protect you and to help you through it. Okay, John, you're on.
Yeah. That's very good advice there. I was listening to Dr. Rowe, and I think that, first of all, I think he raises a lot of very good issues, but almost all of his evidence relates to zero, or as they call it, microgravity situations. He has no real evidence on what would happen if you were at 0.9 G, for instance.
Neither
would that really cause a serious health effect. He doesn't really have that kind of evidence.
He believes, and he has heard it from various aerospace medicine doctors, such as Jim Logan, for example, that they believe, but they don't have any conclusive evidence because nobody knows, that 1 G is the law, and we will find out that trying to live in partial gravity of some sort will likely over the long run not be conducive to human health. So Bill takes his lead from what other aerospace medicine doctors have said, but there, you're right, there is no, you know, bona fide test to tell us whether 38% gravity is great or whether lunar gravity is great or whether 1G is what humans need. We simply don't know. And it doesn't appear that NASA is interested in getting that gravity prescription honed down one way or another. If you recall, when I had the chief science director on for the space station, she totally dismissed those questions and said the key was not what gravity percentage we deal with, but was how to make the trip to Mars go faster, like with advanced propulsion, like nuclear propulsion or something, so that these issues were less of a factor. And that was her focus, was on advanced propulsion. But you're right, Bill does not have absolute fact to support him, but he does have what many quality, incredible aerospace doctors in the trade have said, but it's untested and unproven, and we don't know the answer to it, but we should know. It, you know, if we did the research, we would know.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, I'm saying, but he has evidence. I mean, he's got a lot of data about what happened, particularly in the space station, you know.
Right.
And I guess some of the things he's concluded about the lunar trip, but I think but that may be a different situation having to do with the suit they were using. And
well, he has more evidence on cardiology factors than he does on, say, is 1G really the law, or can you get by with 38% G or something?
My objection is not that there isn't a problem in microgravity for prolonged periods of time, like on a trip to Mars, but the question I have is the idea that you literally have to be left literally 1G. I mean, I think, for instance, I think you'd probably do pretty good at 0.9G and not too bad at 1.1G. You know what I'm saying? But that those planets really don't exist in a habitable way for us to get to at the moment, so it's kind of an irrelevant point, but maybe. But what really the question is, what happens in say, Mars, for instance, at 0.38? That's an interesting question, and we don't have any evidence on it.
And nobody apparently is doing the research to find that out. But as I told Doug in another email which he sent in, which I didn't bother to read on the air because, I mean, there's no reason to hound Dr. Rowe about any of this because it's not his specialty. He doesn't know it. He already said he didn't know it. But Joe Carroll is coming back on the program, and to my way of thinking, Joe Carroll is probably the most qualified or one of the most qualified artificial gravity guys who's thought stuff out, researched, and done things anywhere, and he's been on the show many, many times. And Joe's coming back on in a couple of weeks, and I think these are questions to ask Joe because he probably might know a lot more about it than others, although he obviously can't do the experiments off Earth any more than you or I can because, you know, there's no way to do them off Earth. But Joe is probably a person to ask all of this about far more than, say, than Dr. Rowe. But I know where Dr. Rowe is coming from and where he gets his information, and it would be great if we had the experiments to test out is 1G the law, as Dr. Logan and others have said, or can you, you know, get by with 38% gravity, and for how long can you get by with 38% gravity? But if nobody's willing to do the research, what can one say? I mean, it just hangs out there as questions that need to be answered if we really want to become a spacefaring culture.
Right. Well, we'd have to have a space station where we could actually, you know, spin it up to those different levels.
Or a free-floating thing that you could design to be adjacent to the space station. You could probably design something that would make it work. Remember, they were going to put a centrifuge on the space station early on, and then, you know, they backed off of all of that.
Yeah, I tell you, the other person, the main thing I would be, I'm more in the, at least the advanced propulsion view of things myself, is the
Well, that's fine. You can get to Mars quicker. What do you do when you're on Mars? So you still don't know if 38% gravity on the surface of Mars is going to be sufficient for you. So you can shield yourself with radiation by going underground and doing this and that and the other, or using Mars regolith or water or something. But you can't add to the gravity by going underground or doing that. You have to do something different to get a different gravity level. So you can get to Mars faster, so that radiation and microgravity are not as devastating as if they take 9 months to get there. There's no doubt about that. But what do you do once you're on Mars and you are doing a settlement on Mars? You're stuck at 38% gravity. So does that work?
That's where the experiment would begin.
Well, yeah, I guess you could do on-the-job training, or you could try to do it ahead of time.
If things start getting bad, at least you could come back then.
Maybe.
Obviously we've had people in microgravity for a significant amount of time there.
About a year.
So if you could get to Mars in a couple of months and back, then you'd have 8 months of plan to experiment at 3.8 and get an idea of what starts happening at that point.
Well, your quickest return time would probably be close to, 2.5-3 years from the start, from your launch in Florida?
Well, if you had this advanced propulsion, you might be able to come back much quicker.
Well, yeah, but you don't have it. I mean, this is one of my gripes on the movie The Martian, is because everything about The Martian and what Andy did was a NASA problem and a NASA solution, okay, except they get some help from the Chinese. But it's all a government program, so there is no SpaceX, there is no Falcon Heavy, there is no commercial industry, there is nothing. However, if they really wanted to go rescue the guy, and they're looking at these really long launch windows because of, the logistics of getting to Mars, which all of us on this show know what we're talking about, it would seem to me, and if they're willing to launch a rocket without even testing it, it would seem to me they'd go to the damn warehouse where Nerva sits and bring it out in mothballs and bring it up to date and launch a damn nuclear propulsion rocket to get there in a really quick time to save the guy's butt. But that was not an option, even though that would have still been a NASA government solution, in keeping with the fact that everything about The Martian is a public NASA program. There is no commercial industry talked about in The Martian. So advanced propulsion could have made a difference in how many days and the whole thing for Nowotny on Mars, but it was never an option discussed. Now, whether Andy didn't know about it, or because he got a lot of help from JPL in making sure the scenarios were plausible, and they didn't want to bring up nuclear because it's a politically charged thing. We know that from all the shows we've done on the space show about advanced nuclear propulsion. But Nerva was almost operational. And Nerva sits in a warehouse someplace. So they could have, readied it and got it ready and gotten to Mars pretty damn quick. If you're willing to risk the rocket, which they did, and they risk a rocket, as you know, why not risk going there in a third the time to try to save the guy? So that just seemed to me that it should have been part of the options, given that this was all about a government space program to begin with.
Remember, the spacecraft that took them to and from Earth to Mars orbit is a nuclear Vassimir-powered spacecraft, so they are using advanced propulsion of a sort.
Yeah, but they're not getting to Mars on any, they're needing, 9 months to get to Mars.
They're not pushing to the level which I was proposing.
Right, and when the Chinese come in, and they have boosters that are already there that are a secret Chinese program, hopefully I'm not giving anything away in the movie to anybody, that's conventional rocketry too. All I'm saying is,
provide the supply.
You've got the possibility of a government program of almost perfected nuclear technology from 40 years ago. Dust the damn stuff off and bring it current and go try to rescue the guy, with that. That would seem to me to be a hell of an option.
actually get a nerve thing going from that had been mothballs from the 70s period, then actually get it operated. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, would have been really, really a fun. That added a new dimension to the story. That's for sure.
Well, the movie at least threw one piece of commercial space in, didn't it? The very end. When that next mission is blowing up and they're launching from Earth in a Falcon Heavy, it looked to me like that's what I thought it was.
It didn't look to me like a Falcon Heavy, but you know there were a lot of news articles.
Delta Four.
Yeah, I think it's something like that. There were a lot of news articles that came out before the movie was ever released, while it was still being produced, that were written by new space oriented bloggers and people who really condemned the book as advocating only NASA and government space programs and totally ignoring commercial space and the private sector and SpaceX and opportunities elsewhere. And there was a lot of criticism offered in a lot of the blogosphere, the commercial space blogosphere, that the book did damage to the commercial space industry because it just totally dismissed it as irrelevant. It wasn't even mentioned. So I'm not of that opinion that it damaged the industry because it dismissed it and didn't mention it. But there was a lot of trade talk about that. And again, I don't buy that scenario, but I did read the articles and I do know it was out there.
Yeah, well, anyway, it was a good movie. I mean, actually, in some ways, I guess the movie was a little bit less Perils of Pauline than the book was, if you will. Every time the guy got anywhere, some other fiasco, they left out a few disasters in the movie that were in the book.
But it would have been a four-hour movie, and people would have walked out if they had put on the engineering and everything in that he did. But I thought Ridley Scott did a great job, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And if I get the opportunity, I'd probably go see it again. I would definitely watch it when it comes out on Netflix or on Amazon Prime.
Oh yeah,
I would absolutely, watch it again. You know, that way for sure, 100%.
Well, yeah, it's a show that all space people should go see, and everybody else too, for that matter. But the people I've talked to that have seen it liked it. So
there were about five people who walked out of it when I went to see it, and I went to see it Sunday at the matinee this past Sunday, and there were about five or six people that I could tell that walked out of it about a third of the way through the movie that apparently didn't like it.
Interesting. Well, what I was surprised at when I went to see it was the age of the audience. Because where I went, my viewing, it was a rather older audience. I mean, it was, you know, kind of a 50 to up audience on balance.
Yeah, no, my showing was the same way. And, in fact, I was, as I told you, I brought pillows with me and a cane. But my friend who I went with my son and another friend who does have some handicap capabilities and does walk with a cane. But probably 50% of the people we saw in the theater were walking with canes. And when we were leaving, I was sitting on the bench in the lobby waiting for my son and my friend to come out of the restroom. And when my friend came out of the restroom, he walked by this guy who was also using a cane and asked if this was some kind of cane celebration coming to this movie. There were so many people there walking with canes. So yeah, it was definitely an older crowd. It was not a younger crowd at all. But as I said, it was a Sunday matinee, so it might have had something to do with it,
I guess. Although I would think that the more older people could come during the week more.
Well, but they get special pricing if they come Sunday matinee. So it's really,
that's true.
It's really,
I mean,
cheap for the seats.
I tend to go to those kind of, you know, matinee type showings too, and pricing and a number of things, and this is quite a bit older than what I normally run into at the shows I see. And maybe it's just, you know, it's not really your classic hardcore fantasy action show, so maybe that's why it appeal to a more serious group of people, I guess. Huh?
But I enjoyed it, and I take it you enjoyed it as well, right?
I did, and the people I know, two or three people at work that see it, and they liked it. So
everybody I know who has seen it has really enjoyed it. So
one of them is even a millennial. So
I do know that a percentage of people have in interviews have said they thought it was based on a true story, which I find pretty amazing. But maybe I shouldn't be too amazed anymore. I don't know.
If you ever see this thing on one of the shows called Waters World, there's some interesting people out there.
they people on Waters World would not even know what Mars was. They'd probably think it was a candy bar. So, anything else, John?
Well, very briefly, I ran across something today. I was reading something we don't need to get into, but this is something that British Aerospace had in the 90s and through the early 2000s. A project known as Green Glow, which was working on some kind of an anti-gravity propulsion system. I don't think it made any real progress, by the way, from what I've understood. But I thought it was interesting that they were actually funding it with their own private company money.
Where did you see that? Is it an article you read or something?
Yeah, it was in a book I was reading, but you can find it by Googling Project Green Glow on the Google.
Okay.
There's several references to it, including a book I think that's come out on Amazon now, too.
All right. Oh, I'll put it in the summary when I archive the summary of the show.
So I thought that was interesting that somebody else is working on something like that.
All right. Well, listen, I'm going to take a break. If we do
time for a break.
Time for me to get up
good to have you back.
Walk around. Thank you, John. And listeners, I'm going to take a break. We're a little bit more than an hour into the program. So assuming this is a two-hour open line program, we're halfway there. The line will be disconnected while I take a break because I'm going to get up and walk around and make sure I don't start to cramp up from having sat for an hour. So bear with me, and we'll be back in 3 minutes. For those of you following the baseball game, the Dodgers did win. The game, they beat the Mets 3-1. The game just ended a few minutes ago. I actually would like to have seen the Mets win. I'm PO'd at the Dodgers for that lousy slide where they injured the player the other night. I thought that was a pretty dirty slide, so my sympathies are no longer with the Dodgers, even though they're a California team. But anyway, there's another game coming up, and congratulations to the Chicago Cubs for having won their game. And we'll be back in 3 minutes. And don't anyone dare mention Oklahoma football against Texas. And Marshall, if you're listening and you call in and you mention that, I'm going to hang up the phone on you. Back in three.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Tuesday Open Line show. We do have a caller who has patiently been on hold, so let's go directly to the caller. Good evening, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please? Where are you?
Hi, this is John in Fremont, California.
Howdy, John. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Welcome
good to have you
to
back.
And, thank you.
Best wishes for a speedy recovery.
Thank you.
I saw The Martian.
You like it?
Just loved it. Yeah, I want to go see it again and again. like John was saying, there were a couple of scenes left out from the book. I read the book before the movie too, and
I don't think they could have put everything in the movie. Well, first of all, the books are always better than the movies. You know that.
Oh yeah.
But if they had put all of the technology and engineering and the places he traveled to on the surface of Mars to do everything, it'd have been a 4-hour movie and people would have walked out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Ridley Scott handled it really, really well, and whoever did the screenwriting adaption, I thought did an excellent job.
Oh, yeah, just outstanding. All the performances, the writing, the special effects, everything. You know, I've been just hungry for, you know, hard science fiction, and,
How does Jessica Chastain fly through the zero gravity parts of the space station? Is that all wire work that they
you know,
have them
I'm
do?
Not sure. They may have, you know, if they wanted to make it real, they may have, used the vomit comet, you know, for 30 seconds of weightless things, but they'd have to really make an elaborate set in one of those.
Inside the vomit comet.
Yeah.
I bet it's done with blue screens and wireline work.
Yeah, probably. That's probably the easier way to do it.
But I mean, boy, she looked great swimming through the space station, right?
I agree.
You know, she looks much better doing that than she did in the spacesuit, let me tell you that. So, and I thought Jeff Daniels as the NASA administrator prick was just wonderful in that role. I mean, talk about a great character to be a real jerk. He was the best. I mean, I thought he did a great job.
Yeah, and then that character that did the calculations, the astrodynamics
guy. Oh, yeah, that looks like the nutcase guy, you know, from the homeless street.
He was great.
He was fabulous. I don't know who he is or if he's a well-known actor or not, but he was kind of stole the show. Again, I don't want to do scene spoilers, but he's the one who came up with the calculation for them to be able to go back and pick him up using the spaceship. But he's the last person you would expect to do anything other than clean the halls. so he was perfect. I mean, that was really a great introduction and a great character.
Yeah. Yeah, so regarding gravity research, artificial gravity and such, you know, the Space Studies Institute has on their website one of their I think it's GravHab or something like that.
Yeah, but you know, I've talked to Gary Hudson about it. He doesn't even want to come back on the show and talk about it because there's no money, there's no effort, there's no serious interest in doing it. It's a great project, but it's dead in gravity, so to speak. So it's not going anyplace. I've offered Gary to come back on and talk about it a couple of times. I saw him, the last time I saw Gary was at the New Space Conference in July down at in San Jose. And I said, why don't you come back on and build the project up and talk about it? And he didn't want to do it. There's no interest in it. There's no money for it. There's no nothing. There's this, you know, it's a great project on paper. And it won't ever go any place further than that. And
yeah,
it's too bad.
I don't understand the reluctance to investigate this most important aspect of space development. I mean, I just don't understand it.
Well, most of us listening to this show share your frustration and your lack of understanding. It would seem to me that one of the most fundamental things you would want to know if you want to do space settlement with humans or go beyond LEO or something is what can humans actually deal with in terms of the gravity prescription for, you know, long-term, you know, human existence or short-term or, you know, however you're going to do it. And unless you're willing to find that out, I don't think you're very serious about beyond low Earth orbit space travel. I really don't. I believe that Jim Logan has said it best. He hasn't been on the show for a while, but I really think that Logan has said it best. If you don't get that gravity prescription figured out, you're not going to do anything with humans in deep space. And if you think you are, you're kidding yourself. And the fact that we don't do it and we don't get the research done tells him and others that they're not serious about taking humans beyond low Earth orbit. And I don't know, maybe that's a harsh conclusion to draw, but why wouldn't you want to figure out what the gravity prescription is for people in space? Why would you want to avoid figuring that out?
Well, it's fundamental, and I don't think it's too harsh to put it that way. I mean, it's the truth.
And I think
it's probably going to take private industry or the maker community or someone to come up with an experiment on a private rocket. Like for instance, have you heard of the Space Gambit organization?
Something tells me yes, but I can't place it. So I need you to clarify.
Yeah, I sent you an email on this, and the National Space Society local chapter in Silicon Valley is having a talk by this guy. His name is Alex Kirtan Griffiths, and I think I sent you an online video. He has this organization called Space Gambit, and they support small maker community projects for space development. And if you just Google Space Gambit and look at their team, his name's at the top, and you can probably check out some of his videos. He's going to come and do a talk tomorrow night, so I'm going to go check that out.
Why don't you see if he wants to come on the space show and get me his contact information?
I will do that.
I mean, I'm looking to see where your email is, if I can find it, real quick as I'm talking to you. But Gambit is G-A-M-B-I-T, right?
Yep. I just heard about these guys because, I went to the, I think it's the Silicon Valley chapter of the National Space Society to see what was coming up, and he's going to have a talk, so... it should be interesting, and I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah, and I'd be interested in letting him talk about his ideas on the space show. So get me his contact information or pass on Dr. Space mailing address to him, and I'd be happy to talk to him and see what he has to say.
I'll definitely do that. So, get better, and... I hope to talk to you soon.
Okay, and you're not too far away, so maybe one of these days we'll get together. Fremont's not too far away. So here, I found the Space Gambit, a space program for everyone. This is what you're talking about, right?
Yep.
A space program for everyone. Space Gambit puts space technology in the hands of everyone by funding open source projects that help humanity understand and get into space. We work with partners and the maker movement to find out what's keeping us stuck on Earth, engage the public to find solutions, and share the results with the world. We've worked with NASA and the White House, and we're seeking more partners to help us hack humanity to the stars. Apply for funding, blog post, open source. Is the guy that does it have his information up at the top?
Yeah, if you
meet
go to
the team, okay.
The menu portion and meet the team.
Yeah, that's where I'm going. So you're talking about Alex Kirtan Griffith. So as a project, it looks like he's like 15 years old.
Yeah, when I first saw him, Google him on Google and look at his video. He is pretty young, but I think he's.
as project lead,
20s, early 30s.
Says as project lead for Space Gambit, Alex handles operational and management duties for the organization, travels around the world looking for projects to fund, and works with hacker spaces and maker spaces to improve the survival of humanity in space. They don't really give an email address or anything like that for him. And then you got Pierre Mary as their CTO.
Well, there's a LinkedIn. There's a LinkedIn.
Yeah, I saw that. I'm looking to see who else is involved, if I know any of these people. I'd like to know Samantha, but other than that, there's nobody here that rings a bell to me. Well, I'd be interested in doing a show with them, so let me know, okay?
I definitely will, Dr. Livingston, and good talking to you, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you, and you just call me David, okay?
Okay, thanks, David.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
And so, listeners, we'll take another of your calls if you want to give us a call tonight. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. I don't really want to go into politics at all, but if anybody did watch the CNN Democratic debate and it's over with and you're now listening to The Space Show, if you can answer one question for me, then I would like to know, did any of the candidates or were any questions asked the candidates about our space program, and what did anybody have to say or offer about our space program? I'd be interested in knowing what the proposed presidential candidates have to say about our space program, but that's the extent to what I want to talk about the debate on the show. Did space come up at all? Is it going to be any kind of an issue? And I suspect it did not come up, but maybe someone will call in and tell me that they're in pleasantly surprised, and it did come up, and they all favor a robust program to go to Mars. Another email has come in from June, and June is in Tucson, and she says, many people have criticized the NASA roadmap to Mars. I heard you mention it in the first call of the evening with Dr. Rowe. Why are people criticizing NASA's roadmap to Mars? What's wrong with it? I haven't read it in detail, but I do know that it's a stepping stone approach that eventually gets us to the surface of Mars in the early 2030s. Can you please explain to me why it is being criticized? And June, I can explain that to you. I'm not sure I really want to, only because it's kind of tedious. But maybe let's wait a second here, and maybe somebody will call in who is more eloquent than me and actually wants to delve into why they support or do not support the NASA roadmap to Mars. In case nobody does call in, I guess I'll sort of start. So, number one, it's a very, very costly program. And it requires, and I don't have the stats in front of me, but it requires countless number of SLS launches that are billions and billions of dollars. It then requires another, unbelievable amount of EELV type of launches, Atlas, Delta, Falcon Heavy types of launches. Here, somebody's calling. Maybe they'll be happy to go into more detail than I am. Good evening, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you?
This is Doug from Southern California.
You want to answer her question?
I could take a swing at it.
Go for it, because I really don't want to. It's too it's too tedious to try to go through.
Yeah. I'm on a headset. If it's downstairs, let me know and I can pull it out. I'm just giving my answer here, and that is, I know in the past, David, you in particular, but others have said, we don't have a specific plan for the SLS, what it's going to be used for. Well, it's becoming more clear, sort of the roadmap and all the different missions that it might be involved with. And the fundamental question comes down to is how much is it going to cost to perform that many missions over that many years?
Isn't it like 40 SLS missions or 44 SLS missions or something like that?
Yeah. So in the past, you know, people complain that, well, there's no specifics about how it will be used, you know. The number of confirmed missions was, you know, maybe two, and that was a big problem. What is it going to be used for? Well, we're getting the clear idea, and in my opinion, the more clear it comes, how many times it's going to be launched, and the whole array of missions, if you just think about the cost per launch, it just starts adding up to a horrendously large amount of money. I mean, if I don't know if it is 40, but if it's 40 and if it's, you know, $1.5 to $2 billion per launch at that flight rate, then we're talking, you know, $60 to $80 billion. And so then the question comes, well, is there going to be money left over to do anything else, such as developing the payloads, like the landers for Mars? Are going to be able to continue any sort of space station in low Earth orbit? Are we going to be able to do anything at the moon? Or are we just going to let other countries lead the way there and establish the first off-Earth permanent base? You know, it's, I think, serious questions when you're talking about that sort of money.
Yeah, and his cislunar development is minimal and hardly mentioned. And there's a lot of criticism of going to Phobos. And a lot of technical criticism of going to Phobos. I'm not qualified to really opine on the technical criticism of, you know, what orbit Phobos is in versus Mars and things like that. But as Zubrin says, if you're going to go to Mars, you go to Mars. So the roadmap doesn't do that. It goes to Phobos and does a bunch of stuff on Phobos and then eventually goes from Phobos back down to Mars.
See, I think there's a bit of confusion here, and that is, if in going to Phobos, if that is a, how can I say this, a stepping stone to Mars, it could be a stepping stone of one of two ways. It could be simply going the distance of Mars and then coming back to show that we can reside in the Mars system for that period of time. Then, to me, I would actually support that. I think that's a good idea. But if it's a matter of going to Phobos in order to develop propellant production or propellant storage and then going from there on down to the surface, well, then I think Zubrin is correct. The orbit of Phobos is equatorial, and it doesn't allow you to go to higher latitudes. And when you're coming into the Mars system, you wouldn't necessarily be in that orbit of Phobos. So, but if you are going to Phobos for the purpose of going to Phobos, because that is a cool place to go that doesn't require, you know, a lander and a sender and propellant production, then I think it's actually a legitimate destination. And it's one we can do earlier at less cost than going to the surface of Mars. But what I advocate, and I can understand some concern, that if we go to Phobos, will people then say, well, we've essentially been to Mars because we've been to the distance of Mars, so we don't need to go to Mars' surface. We've essentially been there because we've been to the distance of Mars. I personally don't think that that is a big concern, but if it is, what I would like to see is when crew go to Phobos, that they do low-latency teleoperations on Mars, but not doing science, not operating science rovers, but rather using the low latency telerobots to actually establish a large inflatable and shielded habitat on the Martian surface, with no other purpose than to prepare for the crew to go to the surface of Mars. Therefore, there'd be a real strong binding between the mission to Phobos and the mission to the surface of Mars. It would basically obligate us to do that because that's what we went to Phobos to do.
Yeah, and another part of this, June, is that because the costs are so high for this mission and it covers, 2015 now, let's say to 2032, so we're talking about 17 years or so, that it's not sustainable. So another famous quote from Zubrin, well, it's not a quote because I'm not quoting him, is that you and many people agree with this, you have to be able to start and finish your Mars mission during the term of one president, because trying to think that these projects can be sustained over multiple administrations, changes of party, and things like that is ridiculous. So in a term of a president is considered getting reelected, so it'd be a two-term president, but the same president. It's got to be started and completed within that eight-year period. And that's another thing that Zubrin and quite a few other people say. So a 17-year project over multiple administrations and multiple Congresses doesn't fare well for sustainability.
Yeah, it's, I mean, there have been space programs that have extended beyond a president's term, but in terms of Constellation, that, in fact, was canceled after Bush's term. So there is a risk. I don't know how large the risk is, but I think it is something that one should be concerned about.
Well, and airplane projects, military projects get canceled that way, too. So the F-20, yeah. F-22 Raptor got canceled that way, too. So it does happen, and I think there's probably a lot of merit that says complete your project within the term of the president who's proposing the project.
I personally think if one is showing good progress and in the course of that progress, exciting things are happening, I think that can help to sustain it politically. But the big thing, which I think we all need to remember, is if a program is running over budget or it's getting delayed, that gives a great excuse for the next person to cancel it. If it's going pretty well, like, for example, the public-private programs are going well, then that can be sustained because people feel as though they're getting value for their tax dollars.
Well, I know you didn't call in to answer June's question about the thing, so what was your real reason for calling in?
Oh, yeah, I appreciate that. I have not yet seen The Martian. Just over the past 3 weeks, I've been taking extra shifts and just been sleeping, basically, when I'm off work. But I did take a look at that Hermes, and I sort of counted up the different modules of that mothership. And I counted that it would take like 42 launches to assemble that gargantuan spacecraft. And frankly, I mean, I don't think NASA has any plans for Hermes, thankfully.
It's a sci-fi movie. It's not based on anything that's real.
Well, didn't he sort of base it on NASA plans?
No. What I recall from my interview with him, and by the way, I asked him to come back on the show, and he turned me down, and he said he was busy working on his next book and did not have time to come on and talk about The Martian again. So I was a little disappointed in that, but I certainly respect his use of his time. What he got assistance with from JPL was the scenarios for Nowotny on Mars to do this and that with computers, communications, biology, poop, because, you know, that's a big part of the movie, and other stuff. Were his solutions even remotely plausible? So I don't remember, and maybe somebody who remembers the book a little better than me or maybe paid better attention to the movie, because it's hard for me to focus it on, except on Jessica, but given my nature. But I don't remember him putting any real attention or design effort into Hermes. I think that was just presented, and I know other people are listening who have read the book and have seen it, but I think it was just presented as a given. Now, I know Dr. Lurio saw the show over the weekend, and he texted me, and I have not yet talked to Charles about it, but he said it reminded him a lot of the 2001 movie Spaceship, that Hermes had a lot of similarities to what they did in the movie 2001. So I wouldn't draw any realistic conclusions on how many launches it might take to have made it. The whole thing's a science fiction, not true, fictional, nothing real about it movie. It's just a good movie.
Well, I think Mark Whittington, maybe he wrote an article that said, you know, that basically NASA doesn't have the money to do a Martian. And I think he's totally right.
Well, yeah, but it was more about the Martian roadmap. They don't have the money to do any of that.
Yeah. But so I'm wondering, in net, is this movie a net positive or a net negative? I mean, it's certainly creating a great deal of interest in going to Mars. That's the way it seems to me. maybe that might dissipate, you know, shortly. But NASA seems all over the thing.
I don't know. As I told you, there was a lot of criticism for some of the new space community over the past several months about how the book, because the movie had not come out yet, really hurt the commercial and new space community because it so totally ignored and dismissed it, and everything was a government program and a government project. There wasn't even a public-private partnership mentioned in the movie that I recall. So they were PO'd that the commercial space and the private, you know, sector, you know, were not even mentioned. Even when they eventually talked to China about a rescue mission, why didn't they talk to Elon Musk about sending a Falcon Heavy, you know, or something like that? But none of that exists in the movie. There is no world of commercial or private space in the movie that I can remember.
So I watched Andy Weir doing a sort of on the stage presentation. I forget where it was. I think it's some university. And somebody from the floor asked him about, you know, where is commercial space in his book, you know, in his movie. And his response, what I thought was pretty straightforward, and that is, he says, when he first started conceptualizing and writing the first chapters, SpaceX was just sort of embryonic at that time. It existed, but it was just a, you know, not a big thing at all. So I think that he actually sort of just worked with what he had at that time.
Yeah, and you're right, and he went to JPL, and he had them kind of, could you really do this on Mars? Could you really go, you know, to Pathfinder and make your way there? And could you really reboot it? And there's actually a lot in the book about what it took to find people to work the old computer systems from some of this old technology that he was able to make his way to use. And the movie does mention that a little bit, but certainly doesn't go into it to the extent that the book goes into it. But again, I don't think they could have done everything that Andy talked about in the book. It would have been a 4 or 5 hour movie, and people would have walked out of it.
Right. Let me sign off, but let me just make a comment on, it seems like the theme for today, and that is the artificial gravity. I've said these things before, so I don't feel the need to delve into it, but nobody else has been mentioning these things, so let me mention again. Polyakov's been 437 days continuously in zero gravity. Gennady Padalka has been 879 days in zero G, not continuously, but total, cumulative. A flyby mission it would be of Mars in 2021 would be 589 days, so Polyakov spent 74% of that time in zero-G. By my calculations, it'd take about 15% of the mass of the mission to spin up on a long tether to get up to 1G. So when you put it all together, we do need the gravity prescription, but we really only need it when we're really spinning, you know, extended period of times. And we're talking like basically settlement. For example, on the moon, you don't actually need to know the gravity prescription to go to the moon and stay, because you're always 3 days away. And so my feeling is that there is not an urgency to figure this thing out. I think we ought to get going, especially to the moon, and there'll be plenty of opportunity to figure it out before we really need to know what it is. That's my view.
Well, as I always tell you, find a way to make your view prevail. And that, of course, is a $64 million question for everybody.
Well, I guess mention on the space show doesn't do the trick, because...
Nobody ever says,
well, how long did Polyakov, you know, what percentage of the time? You know, nobody ever says that.
We don't have a big enough audience, and to this day, I've never been able to interview anybody from Congress, including their staffers, that deal with space, and I have had great contacts that claim they'll deliver this senator or this staffer, and it never happens. I've never, ever, in the near 15 years of doing the show, been able to talk to a person from Congress. The closest I came is the Congress lady who was, I think, 2 years ago at the Space Frontier Foundation meeting, and she gave a luncheon keynote address. I forget her name. She's from back east someplace, and she spoke about technology and space. And I recorded her press conference where a lot of us attended, but it was not one-on-one, and I could not get her to come on the space show as a guest. I forget her name, but that's the closest I've come to a Congress critter or a policymaker like that coming on the space show, or their staffer. And that invitation is out there. If anybody can help me get a staffer or a member of Congress on the space show, I don't care what party they are, I don't care what their view is, I don't care if they hate space or if they love space, it doesn't matter. I'd be happy to welcome them to the show.
Well, I mean, because of my specific views, I don't have a need to do that on this topic, because the status quo is perfectly fine with me, because I really don't think that we need to know the gravity prescription anytime soon.
Yeah, so, but you're not prevailing, so, I mean...
And the status quo is fine, so I don't need to...
Well, I understand that, but that's probably not the status quo of the people who would plan a mission, and since they don't care to look this up, I don't think they plan real missions. That's my hunch. I think it's all smoke and mirrors and very frustrating, because I don't think they think like you, Doug. I think they probably think more or less like Dr. Logan, for example, and they don't do this because they don't really have a serious way of budgeting and planning for a mission. So the talk is cheap, and you know, the roadmap to Mars can be a lot of talk and a lot of paper, and that doesn't cost very much money.
All right. Well, David, it's sure good to have you back. Good to hear your voice again.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay, take care.
Listeners, a few minutes ago I referenced a text that Dr. Luriel sent me over the weekend, and I incorrectly referenced Dr. Luriel, so he has corrected me. So hopefully, Charles, you will not get PO'd that I read your corrected text on the air, but I do want to set the record straight. So I'm going to read it directly as what you texted me, so that the listeners will know exactly what you said about Hermes. No, I didn't say it was like the spacecraft in 2001. I said there were three specific visual references to 2001 in the Hermes. And then his subsequent text is the FISO studies, F-I-S-O. And for those of you who don't know what FISO is, Google it, okay? I don't think I'm want to get into it. I got another phone call. The FISO studies have included rotating toruses. So, Doug, I know you listened to the FISO studies, so there might be something there that you've missed that would have some of this information in it. I know that Joe Carroll will reference this when he comes back on the program. Charles, if you'd like to call the show instead of sending me text messages, love to hear from you again, and would welcome your phone call. We do have a caller on hold. It is 1-866-687-7223. Good evening, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Sometimes miracles do happen. It's me,
It is Dr. Luriel himself.
So I gather you just let out my text about the references.
Right. I corrected my ill-spoken comments about your text over the weekend.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where they had... What I meant to say, what I was trying to convey was that, you know, a lot of movies do this all the time. They have certain visual references to antecedent, earlier films, and there were several of them on the Hermes, at least to 2001. There may have been to others as well.
Did you like them? Did you like the movie, Charles?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. Yeah. To me, actually, I actually was surprised by what I thought was a significant degree of focus by the audience on it. I mean, they seemed involved. The audience, I think, was involved in it in a way that, you know, that even though it wasn't a, you know, shoot 'em up, thing, something going up every half second kind of thing. You know, I think they were involved with the story, the human story of a guy who is isolated and overcomes the circumstances that he's presented with. You know, it's sort of like the oldest, it's one of the oldest stories in human, you know, in storytelling, you know. So,
yeah, no, it's a great story, and I think they did a great job with the movie.
Yeah, and I think. So, as you observe that you saw a lot of older folks.
Well, I went to a bargain matinee Sunday afternoon with special pricing for seniors. So I did not know. I did not know that that's the movie that we chose to go to. So we picked a movie where I thought I could sit okay for a couple of hours and be okay.
Right.
And I know that the mid-afternoon works really well for me. The evening is crappy, and I often have to take pain medication in the evening. And I figured if we went to the movie, there's a restaurant across the street that we could go to for a quick dinner, and I could probably handle that. So,
right. So
we picked a time in a movie that worked for me getting out of the house for the first time, you know, since the surgery on October 1st. And when we got there, we found out that it was a special matinee for senior pricing, and we saw all the guys walking around with canes.
Okay, well, you didn't mention the senior pricing thing earlier, so that...
Yeah, it was a senior matinee kind of thing.
So there you go. It's already a, you know, prejudice sample. But anyway, that being said, I will say that I did see a... I went on, it was a 6 p.m. showing on Saturday night, so that's a pretty...
That's a high-powered time.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, that's a popular time.
And there were a lot of young people there. There were a fair number of middle-aged people there, and, you know, a few older people than that. And, you know, but you know, I didn't think it was that out of whack. Now, if you looked at the what was being talked about in the trade publications, the film box office mojo, whatever the hell it is.
Yeah, the reviews and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, they were talking about the audiences that were coming, and they were saying that, it was skewing a little bit more toward guys and a little bit more towards a little bit older audience, but that there were more young people coming over time, apparently was word of mouth. So, you know, as I say, you know, it wasn't your average shoot 'em up, blow 'em up, you know, run 'em over movie that they're constantly, you know, pressing during the previews, but it's still, I thought, kind of, you know, is getting a good response from people, but I think that response is in large part not all that connected to its being on Mars. I mean, people may enjoy the fact that it's on Mars, but I think that's almost incidental to the gut reason why people appreciate the storyline.
But I think the scenery and the computer graphics and how they made everything look like you really were on the surface of Mars, I think that it was so pretty, and I mean, even though it was barren and all that probably added to it and made people really think that this was, like, really real.
I agree, although I have a few... not issues, but little sort of, nits or... I saw what I thought were indications that, you know, they had to rush the effects work. They had only about two-thirds of the time because they moved up the premiere by about a month or two.
Right.
And so they had, like, like I said, about a third less of the time they had planned for. So they had to take some shortcuts, which apparently they were satisfied with. But anyway, you want me to tell you the three references on the...
Sure.
Okay. First shot of the Hermes. It's you see that front part?
Uh-huh.
And there's a big antenna up above the command module, or whatever you want to call it.
Uh-huh.
It's one central antenna, and off to each side, there are two small ones near its base. Remember the antenna on the Discovery?
Uh-huh. So that's very similar.
Yes. The second one is that those halls that where they have the material stored in zero G, that had that same cross section that you had in the storage area when the guy in 2001 is walking through it on his way to the, to confront Hal or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So I thought that was intentional also. And finally, I think the one that was the most blatant was in the 1G area, where if you look behind the folks, where the folks were sitting in, behind them, sort of the lounge area, that furniture looked like it was very much inspired by the kind of this is what the future will look like furniture on Space Station 5 of 2001. It looked not a direct copy, but very similar to some of that furniture.
Let me tell you this. It did not look like the medical back reclining chair I'm using for my back.
Well,
let me tell you that.
Well, you know, of course, in the future we solved all that. Right?
That's right. Worf got a new spinal cord transplanted in him by Dr. McCoy or something, so he never had any back problems again.
I didn't like know that. I didn't. You'll have to
Google Worf getting a new spinal cord. I don't remember the details, but they did a spinal cord transplant for him for back problems, and I think it was McCoy who did it, or maybe,
wait a minute,
maybe
McCoy
it was
100 years earlier, so that was
so it might it, yeah so it might have been what's his name,
whatever her name was.
It could have been her, or it could have been the hologram doctor. I don't know.
I don't know. Anyway.
But one of them gave him a spinal cord transplant. Somebody will probably call in and comment
okay.
on it.
You want me to? I'll throw a couple of. I like the Martian. I like the actor, but I think that, and I like the scenery. But there were a few little nits.
Well,
and as you say, I have the same problem with it that a lot of new space people do, and I understand why Andy was doing what he did,
uh-huh.
because he was, you know, as you were, I think, saying earlier that, you know, basically he was just trying to look at the question of survival on Earth.
Yeah, and he went to JPL for that, and SpaceX and all of that was not in the realm of possibility at the time he was doing all this, and he didn't consider it. So,
right.
You know, he was also accused is too strong a word. It was also suggested that the book, Martian, the movie had not come out yet, was very sexist. And it was male oriented, and women were played down, and he said, well, Commander Lewis is a woman, and this, that, and the other. And I remember that was part of the discussion on the space show, that, you know, was he too overly sexist? Like the political correct crowd is, I guess, you know, looking over everybody's shoulder for everything.
I have to talk to you about something regarding that. At a later date, but this is at a later moment.
But I don't, I didn't think there was anything to that. But, you know, there's people that think there's something to anything under the sun, as you know. And since they can all self-publish now, you know, in the blogosphere or this or that and the other, and they all think they have an audience for what they say, they're, you know, crap is every place and abundant. So I guess you can grow a lot of potatoes out there if you really want to.
Yeah, although I think you'd have to get the perchlorates out of the soil first, don't you?
I don't know. Did he do that? Did he get...
Not in the movie, anyway.
Not in the movie, that's right. John Hunt sent in a note for you. In my case, there was matinee pricing, but not special for seniors. It still was an older than average audience. Maybe it was because I went to a 2D showing. I should have said that I went to a 2D showing. I did not go see. I did not see it in 3D.
Yeah, I went 3D.
Yeah. Did you like it in 3D?
Yeah, although I thought it was, you know, I mean, I don't have perfect vision for that, as you know, because we've discussed this, you know, before. You know, I can usually, you know, it usually works pretty well. I can usually pick it up pretty well. It was relatively subdued. But it did add something to it, certainly.
I didn't see it in 3D. I'm not a big fan of 3D movies. But again, I chose a time that I thought would work with me trying to get out of the house and allow me to sit there without having to get up and walk around or something, you know, for the 2.5 hours of the movie. So if it had been a 3D movie, I would have gone if it had been at that time slot. But it was 2D, and I was fine with that. If I wanted to go see it again, maybe I would pick a 3D movie just to see the difference in it.
I think it might be worth it. Although, they, you know, of course, they charge an arm and a leg, because they charge an arm and a leg for everything.
Of course.
But they charge two arms and legs.
That's
the 3D version.
That's right. And but I guess you get a better view of Mars that way in 3D, right?
Somewhat. The thing that stands out most in the 3D is the little, when he's talking into the recording, into the video, and it logged, and you see those numbers on the left side, which indicate like oxygen level.
And pressure and cabin.
Yeah, right, right. Those things pop out in the 3D. That is the most, just about the most popping out part of the 3D, at least to my eyes.
You mean Jessica Chastain doesn't pop out in 3D?
Well, you know, we can always.
Or that blonde that NASA blonde who discovered Nwatney on Mars for the first time. You know, who was working in the computer room and they were all falling asleep, and then she thought she saw something that looked different, and they discovered that he was moving around on the surface. Remember her? I forget her name. So she probably stood out in 3D.
You know, to tell you the truth, I'm too tired this evening to remember.
That was actually hard for me to see when she tried to show the image on the surface of Mars that she was talking about. That was actually hard for me to follow and to see what it was she was talking about.
Fact that things had moved around.
Right, and then they started showing shadows or something like that, and then you could tell when they'd go, here is before, here is after, and you could see
The
shadow.
Well, yeah, the later ones clearer, but I did see it on the earlier ones, too, so...
Yeah, so then I could tell, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I figured that that's what... You know, she was going to be showing, so I was looking for it.
Yep. All right, Charles, anything else?
Well, David, it's great to have you back on the air.
Thank you.
And, you know, I understand it's a slog. It's a real slog going through this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's
a real pain. No, literally.
Literally, absolutely. Absolutely, and I don't recommend it.
I wish you the best on you know, recovering as well and as completely and as rapidly as you can.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you, Charles.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Listeners, we're coming up on a two-hour program, so unless somebody else really has a burning passion to send in an email or call real quick, I'm going to call it a night at a two-hour program, because that's about where we are right now. I am doing Hotel Mars tomorrow night, so there will be a Hotel Mars archived Thursday morning. And Deborah Factor-Lepore is our guest, and she's now with Ball Aerospace, and she is our guest on Friday. Then we have our regular Sunday show, and then we're back with our regular scheduling, and I have a lot of November dates available and December dates available because I wasn't booking dates while I was down. So if any of you guys have recommendations or who you want to be on the show, or something like that, or if any of you who took a perk out for co-hosting or something like that, you have a show in mind that you want to have, and you have a guest in mind that you want to invite and start in co-hosting that, let me know, because we've got dates this year where we can work that out. So that's for those of you who wanted to either co-host a show or host your own show or be the guest on the show, this is the time to speak up, because we got plenty of opportunities between now and the end of the year to start scheduling people, because I'm now starting to schedule the shows for the last part of the year. But again, I can't sit at the computer for very long periods of time because it hurts like hell. And so I get up and walk around and I break it up. I've been doing that as I've been doing the show tonight. So my productivity is still not back 100%, but it's obviously back enough to do the show. But this is a good time for you to suggest a guest that you want to co-host or you want to host with. And I'm open to that, and I will help you secure the person. So the only requirements are space-related and maybe STEM-related. Okay, we got a call coming in, and this is our last caller, everybody. No more calls after this one. Good evening, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please, and thank you for calling.
Tim from Huntsville.
Hi, Tim. You got in just under the wire here.
I've been trying to get on for a while, but...
People are busy tonight. They all want to talk about The Martian. Did you see the movie?
I did see the movie, yes. I went with a couple of my friends.
Did you like it, and did your friends like it?
Oh, they liked it. Mm-hmm.
And what did you think?
I thought it was a good movie. I kind of agree with some of the people. That thing was kind of, the Hermes was kind of, how do I put it, Battlestar Galactica. I believe that's what Zubrin would call it.
Yeah, probably you're right about that. Battlestar Galactica. Yeah, I think that would be a Zubrin-esque term for it, probably. Maybe. No, so far everyone who's called in who has seen it has liked it. Were your friends space cadets? Had they read the book? Did they know anything about it?
Only one of them is a space cadet. The other two just like science fiction and anime.
And they liked it anyway. They
did liked it.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I haven't met anyone yet who hasn't liked it, and certainly the people who have called in tonight have all been very supportive of it. And congratulations to Andy for an incredible winner, not only in the printed book, but, you know, for, I know you didn't do the screenplay, but whatever role you played in that and with the movie and Ridley Scott and everybody, it's fabulous. So congratulations to you for a job well done. I hope whatever your new book is going to be equally as good, and I hope we can talk to you about it when it's ready on the space show. What else, Tim?
Well, I just want to say that, Matt Damon, he actually had some practice playing an astronaut trying to save his own skin, to get my drift.
He did. He did have practice being an astronaut, but I don't think he's going to be an astronaut for real, do you?
No, he played in Interstellar, right?
Right.
Yeah, they actually played a positive character this time. At least someone that someone can root for.
In fact, I think the role he played in Interstellar should have been left on the cutting room floor. That was one of my thoughts. I thought that was a total superfluous, unnecessary scene that came out of the clear blue, and I don't think it added anything to the movie. But I was not a big fan of Interstellar. This is a million times better.
Yeah, it is a much better movie. I mean, I had high hopes for Interstellar.
Well, I think Interstellar was a little bit disappointing. So, what can one say? And what's the other one that won all the awards with Sandra Bullock? What was that one called?
Gravity.
So I actually enjoyed Gravity, even though the science was total crap. And, you know, the special effects and stuff were really weird, like Sandra's hair never got messed up or anything like that. But I actually enjoyed the movie Gravity much more than I enjoyed Interstellar. But this is, you know, light years beyond Gravity and Interstellar. I mean, this is really a first-rate sci-fi movie. This will be a classic for all time.
There is one thing I want to point out. Someone nitpicked about Interstellar, and they point out that in Interstellar, they launched the shuttles on a expendable rocket, but these things are capable of, they're all single-stage rockets capable of even taking off from a world with higher gravity than Earth. There is one explanation I would go with, and that they use nuclear reactors, and They don't mind burning those things on an uninhabited world, but for safety concerns, they launch it on expendable.
Well, they could have gotten to the Martian a hell of a lot faster if they had used nuclear propulsion.
Oh, I think they did. It was Vastimer. What? Oh, wait, it was solar powered.
Yeah, but I mean they would have had to get rid of chemical rockets and all of that. So you know they did that wasn't part of the story plot, but. One of these days, maybe we'll see nuclear propulsion, you know, for space travel. I don't know anyone who listens to the space show who's not supportive of it. So, you know, I'd like to see it just like you and everybody else. But it's a political football, as you know.
Unfortunately, yes, it is. Probably our best bet is probably India or China using nuclear propulsion.
I wouldn't argue with you. They might.
Oh, did you get my email?
No, I haven't gotten an email from you in a long time.
Must have went into your spam folder.
What is it about?
Oh, it was hilarious. Let's see, the Las Vegas bookies were taking the odds of someone going to Mars, and they rated Elon Musk going to Mars higher than NASA.
No, if you still have it, send it back to me.
Oh, yeah, I will definitely do that.
And I'll put it in the, or I'll reference it, I'll put it in the summary of the show.
Yeah.
If you send it to me tonight or early in the morning.
What's your opinion on those odds?
Well, I don't think any of them are going to Mars, so.
No, which one has a better chance? I mean, Elon, I think there was a 1 in 50.
Well, I think if you're just talking about going to Mars and you're throwing safety, you're discounting safety considerably and things like that, I'd probably say that SpaceX or a commercial company has a more likely scenario of doing that. But if you put in safety and standards and requirements and qualifications and, you know, all of this other crap that one would have to meet, then I would think that NASA would meet things like that easier than SpaceX would and would probably get there faster. But I don't think either one of them are going to get there any time in the near future. So I think it's a pointless exercise, but it's fun.
But, okay, I'm looking at the article, and they gave Elon Musk a 5-to-1 odds of winning the race to Mars, and NASA 80-to-1.
Well, did they say how they gave him the ratings or the odds? I mean,
let's see. I'm looking for it.
Well, send it to me, and I'll see what I can put in the archives, okay?
All right, will do. I do want to comment on, I kind of think that, it's going to be a private company that's going to go to Mars for NASA, and that's only because Congress does not have the will to go there. So if they're controlling the money and they don't have the desire to go, then they're not even in the race. You know, the horse that's not in the race can't win it.
Absolutely. And you may be right. You're not going to get an argument from me. All right, I got to shut it down, Tim. Anything else?
No, that's it.
All right, thank you for your call. I appreciate it.
No problem.
So that's it, listeners. I want to thank you all for calling and participating tonight. For our open lines, and come back for the rest of our shows. Check the newsletter for what's in store. And again, I've got a lot of open dates that I'm going to start filling. So for those of you that wanted the co-host perk or the host your own show perk, if you want to recommend guests or bring people on the show to do that, we got a lot of openings, and it's a good time to start doing that. So let me hear from you. Everybody have a great rest of the week, and as I like to say, keep looking up. Good night from the space show.